All right, so it is good to be back with all of you. Of course, this is home base for me for a Sunday school class, has been for some time. And I do appreciate the time that I've had off because in teaching at three institutions, it's very difficult for me to try to get my brain back into this mode. And also, it had this strange feeling the last couple of times that I did it while I was teaching in all those institutions that it was like coming to work again. And I never wanted Sunday school to feel that way. I never want church to feel that way, like this is a job. I know it is for the whole ministry staff. They can tell you about that. This is not a day of rest for them. But anyhow, I've appreciated being in the choir. I love the choir. I love the music program here. And so just being involved in that has been exciting. What my plan is that I had told you last fall when I was, or before the fall, kind of the end of the summer, that I would make sure that we had a good replacement, you know. And Bogdan was the one, I think, that came out kind of in front of that. Yes, I think he's a good replacement. He went through the same training I did through seminary, and he really, well, you know what he's like. I mean, if you've been hearing him, but he really has had many years to think about texts and to think about lessons and wanting to teach, and he just has not had that much of an opportunity to teach, you know, whole classes with multiple lessons. And so this gives him that opportunity. And I am very grateful that I can just hand the baton over to him, and I know that it's going to be good. In fact, he's much more meticulous than I am. You've probably noticed that. If you ask him a question, he'll dig until he finds the answer. Me, I'm just kind of like, well, I'm not sure. I'll just kind of give you a general statement or something. Once in a while, I'll go digging, but usually I don't go quite that far. But anyway, this summer, the plan is, and I originally was planning on a different lesson series, but this time I was going to just continue in Genesis and probably look at the life of Abraham, which would have been interesting. We ended in chapter 11 of Genesis last year, and I thought, well, we'll just continue on. But when I looked at how many weeks we have, and honestly, the life of Abraham is chapters 12 to 22, that would be packing it in pretty tightly. And it would be difficult for me to, streamline a lot of that to get it done by the end of the summer. This actually works out much better. I have done this before. I have taught this before. In fact, the first time I taught it, I'm guessing it was around 1986 or 87. I was in college coming home. My mom, she's the only one in here that would have been there for that. I was a college student. I hadn't had any seminary training. I think I was learning Greek at the time. But anyway, I had a fascination with the disciples, mainly in just reading the Gospels and seeing their interaction. And I know that if we're talking about the main ideas of the Gospels, obviously the main focus is Jesus Christ, without question. He is the focus, and he as it should be. But all of these texts also bring in little nuggets, I guess, of personalities and conflicts and statements and behavioral things that are going on with these disciples. And so I was fascinated back then with the personalities and just the interactions between them. I noticed, you know, in reading the Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, that there must have been some sort of tension between Peter and John. And then digging into it further, I realized, oh, wait a minute, that's because James and John were the sons of Zebedee, and Zebedee was Peter and Andrew's boss. And so, you know, they worked together. So there's definitely a connection from that. So the personalities is kind of what started it, and also the interactions, and just some of the statements Jesus would make in interacting with individual disciples. And I realized that there are others. Well, my first thought was, others certainly have studied this. And I did find some other resources. There was a John MacArthur book called Ordinary Men, 12 Ordinary Men. There was A.B. Bruce, The Training of the 12. So there were several books that I picked up and started looking through, but none of them really satisfied what I was looking for. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I just need to dig for this myself. And so my thought was, over a summer, I'm pretty sure it was a summer, I did the 12 disciples when I came home from college. I was working. And so I thought, well, we'll just go through these and I will see what comes out. It's always dangerous. I do this when I do intensive studies of biblical books. Different people do things differently. For me, the driving force of study is if I have to teach it. So I will pick books that I don't know, which is very strange. I've done this in college teaching for years. You know, I'll pick, well, I haven't studied Leviticus. Let's do an intensive on Leviticus. Usually most professors, I think, pick the ones that they've already studied and they already know. But that keeps my nose to the grindstone and just kind of focus. And also it's discussion oriented, so the students will bring up things too, and that always helps me. I'm going to move this because I'll knock it over. So with this study, I thought that I was just going to be looking at the different personality traits, and it turned out to be something quite different. It shifted gears along the way because the focus of so many of these texts about the disciples is Jesus' relationship to the disciples and their relationship to him, and particularly in how he was training them for what he had intended them to do. And looking at that, which that's where A.B. Bruce's work, The Training of the 12, helped a great deal, because the focus of so many of these texts is not so much on, oh, Peter and John are fighting again, or we have to keep Simon the Zealot away from the tax collector Matthew because something bad will happen. None of that. It's mostly how God called, or how Jesus called them and formed them into what he wanted them to be. And the contrast between what they were and what they were going to be, or what they would be, is what stood out in the study. The notes were not produced in the 1980s. Okay, I did the study. I had my own handwritten notes. I think I still have some of them in files, but they're kind of sketchy. But then later in the 90s, I taught a Sunday school class here, co-taught it with Jeff Webster. It was Koinonia class. And yeah, Karen and Dennis, they know about that one. But anyway, it was 8 a.m. in the morning, I believe. I think that's when we... Oh, really? Okay, I did not know that. All right, well, no pressure there. Anyway, so I did it for them, and that's when I really produced the notes. And then I had someone in the class, Donda, you know her, said, you need to teach this elsewhere, you know, and she was always very kind of, you know, she could make me do things that I didn't want to do sometimes. And she said, well, we live in the Glen Lakes community, which is kind of north of North Park Mall, gated community. And anyway, she wanted me to do a Bible study there, so I did it there. And then I also was involved in a thing that DTS had started years ago called the Friday Morning Bible Class. Now, if you think 8 a.m. is bad, try 7 a.m. on Friday mornings. So I did it there as well. That was started by... Haddon Robinson, I think, years ago, and then Bruce Waltke taught there, and it was, I can't remember all the people, but it was all sorts of different DTS people that had taught there, so I was filling some big shoes. Anyway, I did it there, too, and everywhere I've taught it, people seem to like it, but my main application side to it is, and this is really what opened my mind to it, it's that if God calls someone in their weaknesses, that is, in the things that they are especially, areas that are weaknesses in their life, and then turns those weaknesses into strengths. In fact, really, he's working through the weaknesses to make them strengths. That seems to be a pattern. Now, when I study Old Testament, I find similar patterns. Moses, I can't speak. Well, fine. You're going to write 5 books and also spend a lot of time talking. There just seems to be this pattern that the Lord will call us in our weaknesses. And the key text for that is actually going to be in the notes here on this front part, and that's Paul's writings in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. And we'll look at those momentarily, but it's essentially that God uses the weaknesses. That's where he calls us, because that is where his glory shines. And so each one of these disciples, what we know of them, some of them we don't know much. Some of them it's just names. When we get to the end, we'll just be names. Excuse me. I'll give you what information we do have, but there's not going to be as much. Peter, we could spend the entire summer on him, but I don't plan to because I want to look at all of them. But Peter, we have a great deal of information. John, strangely enough, we don't have as much unless you take into consideration his gospel and his words. If you see how he describes people and things and what Jesus is doing, you get a little more impression with him. So the study is quite unusual for me in this sense, and it actually even was when I started it back in the 80s, and that is I am not a topically driven teacher. I have to be in certain classes. There are some classes that I teach where it's a topic, it's not a text of Scripture. It's like a whole bunch of texts of Scripture. I avoided teaching theology for this very reason, because theology, you have to be topically driven. If you're going to talk about Christology, Christ, you're going to be in a lot of different Bible texts, not just one. I feel most comfortable when I'm working through a text or working through a whole book or passage. Part of that is just the way my brain works. I require structure, and that keeps my structure, and it also keeps me from chasing rabbits all over the place. I still manage to, all of you know that, but I can at least look back down and say, oh, the next verse. I can do that. In a topical class, it's a little harder to do that. I'm moving around. So even though it's topical, I am going to be focusing on specific texts each time we meet, and that's just to kind of hone in certain key texts. But I also want us to turn our minds towards what these gospel texts tell us about the disciples and how that might be applicable for our own lives as well, and just to see how Jesus works in our lives. Because he has called us. We are called as both disciples and apostles, just as they were. Disciple means a student. Apostle means one who is sent. And so we are not just sitting at Jesus' feet alone, but we are called to be sent to the world. And he wants us to go to others. And so that's exactly how they are called. All right, so you have notes. I will apologize. These are the notes that I had from the 90s, actually, and I looked through them, thought that they were good enough to send to Karen, and so you have those. Now, as I've looked through them as now I've been over 20 years as a professor, and I've graded tons of papers and many different things, I've found a few grammatical things here and there, and then I find a few things where this could have been worded better, I probably could have added this text, things of that nature. So I'll give you that warning ahead of time. I'll probably point out the errors because I'll correct my own paper as I go along. I think it's still in generally good shape. It at least tells you the backbone of how I'm structuring it. So today we're going to be in those first set of notes. So you have those in front of you. But the introduction to the 12 disciples, I don't know how far I will get into this. My plan is, of course, to go through the summer. There's one caveat. Next week, I will not be with you. Bogdan, I think, will be back. Is that correct? Which is good because he's wanted to continue on, you know, with what he's doing, too. I feel bad. We're close friends. We're very close friends. And I don't like interfering with him. He doesn't like interfering with me. It's like we're in this strange mode right now. But anyway, next week he'll be back with you. The reason for that is we're having, if you haven't heard, we're having a concert at the Meyerson next week. The choir, orchestra, we joined with Park City's Baptist Choir yesterday. We've got a lot of sound. Of course, it's the Meyerson, so there, it can handle a lot of sound. But when we were practicing yesterday, I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is like a wave of sound. I hope anyone who's asleep is going to be awake after we start singing. But anyway, that's going to be next Sunday night. But next Sunday morning, Anton Armstrong, who is the director of St. Olaf's Choir, has been for years, is going to be with us in the church service and will actually be conducting us. So one of the numbers that we're doing for the concert as well. So I kind of committed myself to, I need to be in both services next week. But that's just my other life, I guess. All right. Okay, so on these 12 disciples, what I want to note in here is I'll look at a couple of these texts that we have on the listing of the disciples, and I'm going to kind of mix a few things together. I do want you to notice that there is, after it says their identification, they are always categorized in these groups. Every single one of those lists always puts them together this way. And it seems that there is a distinction between the four, and the four. The last group, group three, other than Judas Iscariot, and that's mainly because of what he did, we do not know much about them. All right, so these last three, James, son of Alphaeus, you might not have even remembered that there's another James. I'm sure they had nicknames for one another. They weren't going around and saying, well, you're James, son of Zebedee, you're James, son of Alphaeus. I'm sure maybe in their Aramaic context, there's a Jim and a Jimmy. I don't know. I'm not sure, but anyhow. And there's also more than one Judas as well. So I always felt bad for Judas Thaddeus because, you know, oh, you're Judas. Oh, well, you know, no, that's the other one. I'm not that one. And Simon, interestingly enough, we have two of those as well, because Simon Peter was Simon. His name is being changed to Peter by Jesus, but then Simon the Zealot is the other one. So we have these that are kind of duplications of other names, but they're definitely different men. So they're organized in this form. Let's go to Matthew chapter 10 a moment, and again, I'm just going to warn you, this is topical study, so I'm going to be moving in different passages. I'm trying to keep the number of passages limited, so we're not like looking at 20 or 30 in a day, but I do want to see how they are introduced in each of these texts. And the second thing that's in the notes, besides their identification, is their choosing. And I have a bunch of what I would call observations about their choosing. One of those observations is something I've already mentioned to you, and it is actually number 5 in their choosing. They're chosen both to learn from Jesus as disciples and to be sent as apostles. And that is from the very beginning. There are a lot of misconceptions people have when they're not paying attention to their scriptures too well. They just have these ideas and they think that these men were first just to sit at Jesus' feet and just learn from him and not do anything else. That is not the case. In every one of these texts, it always identifies them as both disciples and apostles. In fact, I'll go so far as to say I think this is correct. I believe now after looking at it more and also looking at other people's opinions on this, it seems that what distinguishes these 12 is that they are more than disciples, because Jesus had a lot of other disciples. When we get to Luke, we'll see that that really they are called out from another group, a larger group. So Jesus has many people who are following him and listening to him and learning from him, but these specific 12 are called to be sent. So they are his emissaries. They are his messengers. And he picks them specifically for that purpose, it seems. So chapter 10, now this is one of our 12 disciples. I'll keep pointing that out as we go through these texts. When we're in Matthew and we're in John, these are actual disciples. They're part of the 12. So they will have perhaps a different perspective on things. I will mention this. John is incredibly helpful for this study because he provides information about the lesser known ones. He has some details about the lesser known ones than the other gospels. So the other gospels don't have that much detail. Matthew, understandably, has quite a bit about his own call, you know, because he was there, he was part of that. Mark, probably John Mark, most likely, was not one of the 12, but might have been one of the disciples. There's all sorts of speculation. You have this strange event in Mark 14. In fact, I can't get it out of my head ever since I knew about it and heard about it. There's like a teenage boy, a young boy, who hears a lot of commotion. This is in the arrest of Jesus, and he like puts on a linen thing over himself, but he doesn't have any clothes on underneath. The soldier grabs the linen and he runs off naked. And he actually has that detail in there. We think that's John Mark. It's anonymous. I guess I wouldn't write my name there either. But anyway, so he probably was part of the larger disciple group, but young, certainly young. And we know he's young when, if this is John Mark, when Paul and Barnabas get in the debate about him with the mission. You know, they're going on mission, and Paul wasn't too happy with some of the things that John Mark was doing. So anyhow, Luke is the one that's definitely an outsider, because Luke would not have been a part of the gospel, or I mean the disciples, the 12. He comes later. He's coming under Paul's ministry. So Matthew and John, they actually are eyewitnesses because they're part of all this. Mark might have been an eyewitness, but he wouldn't have been part of the 12. And then Luke is outside. All right, so let's look at 10:1. And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. The names of the 12, and notice it's 12 disciples in verse 1. Now all of a sudden, 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. Matthew 10. Yeah, Matthew 10. And now I'm in verse 3. So the next one is James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now, of course, this is just a fairly basic list, but it's always important when you have lists that you want to pay attention. This would be true in genealogies as well, to any little details that are included. So Simon is one who is called Peter. Now, we haven't even come to the story yet where we have the details, not in Matthew's gospel, but Simon is going to be identified as Peter. and Andrew, his brother, and then James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. So we have two sets of brothers. And as you dig into this, you find out that Zebedee is connected to Peter and Andrew as well as the one who's in charge of that fishing, business that they have. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, but notice that there's an and actually I'm reading from ESV, but it's very accurate to the Greek. The ands are telling us that there's a pairing going on between them. Okay, not that they're necessarily connected, but Philip and Bartholomew connected in some way, Thomas and Matthew, and then Matthew is identified as the tax collector. This is from Matthew's gospel. So Matthew's identifying himself that way. And then the rest of them you have there. But notice when we get to Judas, it's who betrayed him. Now, if you didn't have the little statement about who betrayed him and you were reading through these gospels, you would be wondering, just as the disciples were on that final night before Jesus was put to death, who is it? Who's the one who's going to betray him? Because Jesus has already pronounced there's going to be a betrayal. And is it I? I mean, what a strange question. That means that they're not even sure. Now, if you read John's gospel, he goes so far as to say, we knew he was a crook from the beginning. But anyway, I'm not sure. John's an interesting character when it comes to some of that. So this is the list, and we can see that they are organized according to, I'm the one putting them in the group categories, but they're always listed this way. Please notice that they are disciples. They've been given authority to do a lot of the same things that Jesus is doing, and this is early in his ministry. So that means that he's healing the sick. He is casting out demons. They are called to do the same thing. So this is a special group. We don't see anywhere else in his ministry where he identifies any other of his followers to do these things. So from this early period, they are already set apart for a particular purpose. Now, I know this seems repetitious, but let's go over to Mark chapter 3 a moment. There's a detail that Mark brings in that we do not have from Matthew. And the detail is going to be especially noted in Luke. Luke's going to really emphasize this. But Mark's giving us the hint. Mark chapter 3, verse 13. And he went up on the mountain and called to him, those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. And then we have the 12. Mark says it a slightly different way, but, many scholars think that one of Mark's primary mentors, this is more church tradition and other things because we don't have the details of Mark, but that one of his primary mentors was Peter. And it makes sense. If he was a young man and among the disciples, Peter taking him under his wing would be logical, or any of them. But notice that the way he describes Simon here, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, it's a little bit different than what we have in Matthew. Okay, so it's identifying that in Matthew it was just who is called Peter. Here, it's to whom he gave the name Peter, which from Peter's perspective, that's significant. Actually, from all the disciples' perspective, that's going to be significant because Peter is anything but his namesake. Anyone know what the name Peter means? Petros in Greek means rock. Yeah. there's not much rock-like characteristic in Peter in his early times. I mean, maybe the stubbornness side, perhaps. But I mean, as far as the you know, being strong and secure and confident and all of that. I mean, he has the confidence to butt in and ask questions, but he doesn't have kind of a directed sort of stability. The stability is not something you think of with him. So that's unusual. And then you also get James, to whom he gave the name. And this is interesting, too. For a long time until I read this, I thought, oh, they were just called this, Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. I thought that was everyone else's comment. But here it says Jesus gave them that name. Ha. Huh. All right. So you sons of thunder, get on over here. You know, so to be called sons of thunder, and I don't think that's meaning that Zebedee is some kind of, you know, Zeus-like person or something. I think it's because of their personalities. We'll see that as we get in here. So Mark is giving us those details. Okay, the one that actually gives us the most detail about especially one point is Luke. So come over to Luke chapter 6. And I really want to kind of glance over 5 and 6 because just kind of a general thing. I won't go through the whole part, but I want you to know in Luke chapter 6, verse 12, it says, "In these days he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples." Now, we have the mention that he is praying, that he is, you know, with his Father in Mark, but here in Luke, it's a little more explicit. Another interesting point, Luke brings this up, and this is unusual for the rest of them. He called his disciples and chose from them 12. Ah, now we have the big group. Luke's the only one who mentions the big group in this context, that there are a lot of disciples, and from those, he picks 12. Now, that changes the way that I read the other accounts. You know why? Because when, if you go back to chapter 5, jump back to chapter 5, we're not going to read it, but I want you to look at it if you've got a text. In chapter 5 of Luke, chapter 5 is about the calling of disciples. The very first account that you have there is the calling of Simon. And so the question is, you know, some debate this on the question of chronology. Luke is not always chronologically in order. He says he's writing an orderly account, but not all orderly accounts have to be chronological. So some argue that. I'm going to make an assumption that this is chronological, but here's how this might be working. When Jesus is calling specific disciples, maybe it is, God-man, I'm not sure how that mind works, but he might be thinking, well, this is going to be one that I'm going to call to send. But in the text here, you don't get that impression. And Luke is almost reminding us that, no, he gathers all of his disciples together, and out of the whole group, he calls 12 specifically. They are then called at that point. Did Peter know that he was going to be one of this special group when he was called? From Luke's writing, it doesn't seem like he did. Peter was, you know, he wasn't called Simon and then said, I'm going to call you Peter and you're going to be one of my 12. One of your who? You know, something like that. You know, whom? Who are you talking about? That special group seems to come after that event. And so a lot of the things going on in chapter 5, in fact, this kind of puts a lot of things into perspective. This is the same chapter with the plucking of the grain and others griping about your disciples are doing this, and your disciples are eating with sinners. And we always picture 12 people there. You know, the 12 are sitting there eating with sinners. No, this probably is the bigger group. It's like all your disciples seem to be doing this, or at least all the ones who are following him. So it's not until chapter 6 that we really have the identification. Now, what can I make of this? That the 12, although they are still part of those whom Jesus is teaching, that he is training. He's really teaching and training the whole group. But he has a specific group that after a whole night of prayer, he comes down and he calls them. Now, when he goes to the mountain to pray, we don't really have any of that. That happens several times in the Gospels. When the crowds press in on him, he goes up to a mountain to pray. Now, we get a little bit of a glimpse of what the prayers might look like when we see John, because John gives us some of the prayers that Jesus is giving to his Father and the relationship between the Father and the Son. But we really don't have that. But my thinking is this. In fact, this really fits a lot of ancient backgrounds as well, is that mountains are the places where people commune with their deities, with their gods. And you remember that if you go all the way back to Moses, Sinai is that place. Moses goes up there to speak to the Lord. Now, certainly God is everywhere. You can pray anywhere. You can be anywhere. But there's something special about the mountaintop. One is the isolation, but the other is also just that symbolism. It is almost like Jesus is functioning like another Moses, which he's going to function like another lot of things. Okay, Adam, Moses, Noah, actually, in a few spots. I mean, there are a lot of places where he's functioning like major characters in the Old Testament. He's the one that brings them all together. But here he is praying and then selecting the 12. So that little detail you don't find in any of the gospel writers. People, when they first encounter that we have three gospels, actually we have four gospels, three that are very close to each other, first three. Why do we need three gospels? There's even a joke. I don't know if you've seen it. There's like a little cartoon joke that people have put together. It's Jesus speaking to his disciples, and the caption is, please listen to this carefully. I don't want four different accounts of this. Okay, anyhow, that's just the joke. But why do we have the different ones? But because the different perspectives, the different details are significant. In fact, the amazing thing about the Gospels is you can study them individually, and you will get a perspective of Jesus from that particular writer that's completely accurate, but it's their perspective, and the things that they include, the details that they include, are selective. And then you read another one, and you get a different set of details. Some people think the way to study the Gospels is pull them all together and then look at all that. That's a good way to do it, but there's also value in seeing each of their perspectives. I'm pulling them together because I'm looking at this one thing. But you can see the differences. okay, so I think those are the main things I wanted to say about that. Oh, and I won't turn to it, but Acts 1:13 lists the disciples as well, minus one, right? In fact, the whole point in Acts 1 is that we are missing one of the 12 because Judas has already died. And in fact, Luke includes that in Acts chapter 1. And then there is the casting of lots, and then they select Matthias. And then he becomes the other one. Okay, well, that's a lot of detail there. But anyway, so those are the lists. Now, let me just mention a couple things about the choosing. And I'm going to say some of this is, remember, these notes are written after I did the study, not before. So it's not kind of an open-ended, let's see what happens. Some of these conclusions I have arrived at because of the study. So the first is, and I guess I decided I'd say not very loudly, but anyway, not because of who they were, but because of what Jesus wanted them to be. The reason I put that first is that was the eye-opener the first time I studied this. is it Peter is not chosen, Simon is not chosen, because he is everything that Jesus is looking for in that leader. That is not how he chooses Simon. He's not choosing John, the James and John sons of thunder, because he just is, just love is pouring out of him. Because that is not the case, not at all. We'll see, James and John both, call down fire from heaven and destroy that village because they weren't listening to you. They seem rather impatient. John's impatience comes through in his writing as well. His competition with Peter is obvious. Even his mother gets involved. It's at a certain point, it's like, well, now my sons, they should be the ones in charge of your kingdom. Okay, so we have those little tidbits, but Jesus is not choosing them for who they are, but who they will be. Okay, that's the big issue. And when I discovered that pattern here, I started looking at other places in Scripture and discovering the same pattern over and over again. Even some of the writings will tell you this. If you look at Amos's prophecy, he says, well, I'm not a prophet or a son of a prophet, but for some reason, God's called me to be a prophet. Now, that part's my little, added extra there. But he was just a farmer. And yet God calls him for this other purpose. So the way that God seems, this is the pattern, okay? I can never, ever predict what God is going to do because I'm not him. And he tends to do a lot of unpredictable things from our perspective. That happens quite often. In fact, he seems to be the God who likes surprises. I will call him that. I've even called him that in my prayers before. So, yeah, you seem to really enjoy surprising people. But there are patterns. And one of the critical patterns that we can learn from this study is that the way God calls people, the way that he draws them to himself, is not because of who they are, but because of what he wants them to be. And he will develop them into that. And often it's happening through weaknesses. It's happening through the very places that if we, from our human perspective, were looking at them, we would say, that's the last thing I would do with that person. This goes all the way back. I mean, 1 Samuel, you have Saul. Why did Israel like Saul as a leader? Because he was tall and he looked like a leader. And instead they get a shepherd boy. And the shepherd boy is the one that God calls because God doesn't look on the outside. He sees the heart. So there's something else going on. Another thing is there doesn't seem to be any consultation or advice from others. Now, I would change this based on Luke. Others except his father, okay, the Godhead. But I'll stand by my statement. No consultations from any other human beings that are on the earth at that time. There doesn't seem to be any sort of meeting with the disciples. No one's drawing straws. They wouldn't have done that anyway. It would have been lots. No one is saying, well, let's have a vote. Who would you vote to be the leader of this group? I will guarantee you not a single one, if they knew him, would have picked Simon. And certainly James and John would not have. So there's no consultation, there's no advice from others. This is coming strictly from Jesus and from the Godhead, okay, which is the way it should be. The one that says after prayer, I mentioned Luke, but I'll say that the Mark passage also brings that up. But also I would add to that called from a larger group. So if I were adding anything to number 3, I would say called from a larger group. This is an unusual one. The apostles themselves, that is this special group, is limited to 12. It never expands. It never goes into, let's get number 13 here. Oh, well, let's get 14. Or any reduction until you have Judas Iscariot betraying. It stays at 12. Now, there's significance to that because 12 seems to be a number that has been used, that God has used before. 12 tribes. There seems to be some kind of, some will call it the number of representation. That's our designation of it. But it seems that when God is selecting people who are going to be representatives of a larger group, 12 is a common number. So very similar. And in fact, when you get to the book of Revelation, you have the 12, like the elders, and you have the 12 apostles. You have those numbers coming up again. All right, and then chosen both to learn as well as to be sent. The word disciple comes actually from a Latin word, discipulus, and it is just the word for student. That's the simplest translation of it. The Greek word is mathetes, which is a different word, but it has a similar meaning. We call them disciples because that's just in our tradition. I took Latin in high school, and I still recall my teacher, who I think thought that we were elementary school students. I enjoyed it. I loved the class, but I remember the first day, you know, you're in high school. First day, you know, everyone else is treating you not exactly like a full-fledged adult, but at least, you know, responsible enough. And so they're treating you a different way. She walks into the class with this big smile on her face, and she says, "Salvete, discipuli." And it's like, what is that? First of all, I don't know what that is. And then why are you smiling at me like that? It's making me nervous. Anyhow, it was kind of the moment of, we're back in elementary school again. Well, this is what you say. You say, "Salve magistra," which is hello, teacher. So, yeah. But discipuli, that was like the first word I probably learned in Latin because of that, the plural form of it. Anyway, so discipulus, that's the word for disciple. And then apostle is coming from the Greek word apostolos, which means one who is sent. Now, this is a conclusion, okay? Number 6, common and ordinary, not extraordinary. We think of them as extraordinary only because of what we see later. Oh, Peter, my goodness, the one who preached on the day of Pentecost. Do not think that when you're reading through the Gospels. That is not who he is at that point. He becomes that, but he is not that at the beginning. You would not want him standing on the steps of the temple and saying much of anything while Jesus is still there. He's liable to say anything and make all kinds of strange comments. Now, this is where, and I'll probably, we'll do this passage and that will be it. So I do have some stopping points. We'll stop in these notes here. But I want to take you to Paul's writings just a moment. 1 Corinthians, because I do want to allow a little time for questions here. So 1 Corinthians, we'll just read these. I think you're familiar with this. Chapter 1. And verse 26, I have gone back to this passage so many times because I feel a part of it, I will say. And I've also seen it happen so many times. Verse 26, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth." And when he says not many, well, of course, he's speaking to the Corinthians, so there is a mixture there. But if Jesus were to say these words, it would be, I don't know if any of you are noble birth or any of you, I mean, it would be a tiny, tiny number. "But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are." There's a lot of philosophical stuff going on there. "So that no human being might boast in the presence of God." It's nice that he has the purpose statement, because you can observe the other things. If you look at early Christians, you look at the disciples, you're going to say, where are the kings? Where are the judges? Where are the prophets? Where are the ones that we're expecting to have the message and expecting to be the leaders? You certainly aren't, you guys. You know, in fact, we even have one here that keeps a knife with him to kind of kill Romans if he can find them, you know, or anybody who's a traitor. I mean, these are the riffraff, as some have said. And yet, those are the ones that he chooses to be his representatives. And the reason is that no one will boast. One of my litmus tests for is it God or is it me? And I can never always determine that. Our psychology is complex. There are times when I'm thinking, oh, God put this thought in my mind. And then there are other times it's like, well, that might have been me. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of cases like that. But the one pattern of God seems to be, one that comes up again and again, is that when he is the one doing it, there will be no question, because it's nothing that you would have done or thought, and it's also something that will only bring him glory, and there won't be any left over for you. No one's going to look at you. If you think that God's called you to a particular thing and you're doing it, people who know you, people who understand where you are and your background and all of that, if they say, well, that sure is a shock, that's probably God. But if they say, oh, yeah, we always knew that person had that talent, it's like, then it might not. I mean, not that God's not working. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that what his pattern seems to be is that the glory is going to go to him. And the way that that happens is through those weaknesses. So anyway, that little passage there. If you're wondering about the 2 Corinthians 4, I won't turn there, but it's the one where he called vessels. It's the vessels of clay and common vessels to fulfill his purposes. So it's a very similar idea.
Kevin, would you mind closing us in prayer?
Oh, certainly.
Thank you.
Heavenly Father, I do thank you that we're embarking on this study. I do pray that you would guide our thoughts, guide my thoughts, guide the thoughts of those in the class. I know that even though we're being guided by texts and your word and different places that we're examining, that you are the one who is truly teaching us. And you can teach us not just in the mind, but in the heart. And that your truths can penetrate our lives in such a way that our lives will be transformed. So I do lift up this study to you throughout the summer. I pray that your presence would always be known and felt amongst us whenever we are in the pages of your word. And I just pray that whatever changes, whatever transformations, whatever things that you would like to do in our lives, that you would be free to do those. You will be anyway, but you may this class not be a hindrance to that, but may it actually be a conduit for your blessings and your changes that you have for us. Thank you for these things. We lift up the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, our God, our Savior, and the one to whom we owe everything. In Jesus' name.